Hi, I'm Stephanie Trithewey, the founder of Motherland, a national charity that supports rural mums across Australia. Welcome to the Motherland podcast, where each week I share with you real and raw stories of motherhood told by women on the land. It's a wild roller coaster we're all on, so no matter where you live or what you do, remember that we're in this together and you're not alone. So, what's it like to raise kids on the land? This is Motherland.
So, Carly and Catherine moved in with us, and we weren't really sure of how long they were going to be in there. But so, poor old Catherine, it was probably the best form of contraception she's ever had as a young girl.
Kate Pierce lives on a sheep farm in the southern Flinders Ranges of South Australia with her husband and five-year-old twins. Her motherhood journey takes the saying, it takes a village, to a whole new level. It took Kate 3 years and 9 embryo transfers to have her twins, who were born at 28 weeks, weighing just a kilo each. What followed was a 3-month stay in hospital before she finally brought her babies home to the farm. Then, just as she was adjusting to life with newborns, Kate's cousin and best friend moved in. And what happened next can only be described as a bit of a circus. But before we hear Kate's story, a quick word from our summer season sponsor. Did you know that those living in rural and remote Australia have up to 3 times the prevalence of avoidable chronic illness? The RFDS works to overcome this, providing a comprehensive range of health services to these communities. The prevention of chronic illness, disease, and mental health problems is what drives RFDS operations. They're now delivering some 68 primary healthcare clinics on a daily basis, with about 921 patient contacts a day. Whilst the RFDS will always be known for its aeromedical services, primary healthcare now makes up 2/3 of their daily operations, as a continued emphasis on prevention is vital to see better health outcomes for those that live in the bush. From immunisations, health checkups, referrals, or management of chronic conditions, RFDS primary health services means there is regular medical assistance when needed for people living and working in remote Australia. Head to the Flying Doctor website to find an RFDS primary healthcare clinic near you. The link is in today's show notes. This is Kate Pierce's story.
Kate, welcome to Motherland.
Thank you for having me.
This is exciting. It's exciting. You and I met, you invited me to speak at your Rural Women's Day event in Oruro in South Australia. And you and I had a really quick chat and you dropped a few bombs about your own motherhood journey. And I said to you, I'm going to follow you up and get you on the show. And you're like, yeah, sure, whatever. Anyway, here we are. You've taken me up on the offer. Thank you. I'm so excited to chat a bit more.
Oh, thank you for having me. As I said, I feel a little bit nervous, a little bit like a fraud. I'd probably had a few bubbles in by the time I'd said, yeah, I'll do that. So, we'll see how we go.
Well, thank you. You have quite the story to tell and I'm so excited to share it. So just as a starting point, can you just introduce yourself to everyone, tell everyone where you live, what you do, you know, who makes up your family?
Sure. So obviously I'm Kate. I live with my husband and my 2 5-year-old twins, Hudson and Lottie, and my husband Nick on a sheep farm just north of Oruro in the southern Flinders Ranges in South Australia. We have lived here on this farm for nearly 6 years. I certainly did not grow up on a farm, and it has been a baptism of fire for me with some tense and some funny moments along the way of my induction into farm life.
So where are you from? Where's home?
Originally from Whyalla in South Australia, which I grew up in Whyalla with my mum, dad and my sister. Had an amazing childhood. Whyalla it's we thought we lived in a country town, but hindsight, I wouldn't classify Whyalla now as a country town. It's a small city. going from a town of, you know, 20,000 people to a town of 800. Yeah, my context on what country life is like differs very much so than it did when I was growing up. But I headed to Adelaide for boarding school when I was in year 10 and lived in Adelaide for 15 or so years doing boarding school, uni, and then starting out my career, which I kind of thought that's where I would be. But, yeah, fate had other ideas.
It did. So tell me a bit about that. So after boarding school, what were your plans? What was the goal work-wise and living arrangement-wise?
Yeah, sure. After boarding school, I mean, such a great time of my life. You know, you meet so many amazing people from all over the state. So after school, it was straight to uni for me, and living in a share housing with friends. So we were all very excited. We were going to do all these things, and we did, and we had a great couple of years, which now astounds me looking back how we actually survived on, you know, 2 minute noodles and me goreng and box wine and beer, I guess. So I did sport and recreation management. I've always been really into sports and project management side of things. So that's where I had anticipated that my career would go. And in order to do that career, it's city living, really. So which I was absolutely fine with. I really didn't know any different.
So what was in first move after uni?
First move after uni, I was really lucky in my final year of uni, I got a job with Netball South Australia. So, and I was a keen netballer myself, had kind of gone through the system of the Netball SA stuff. So got a job there and I thought, right, I'm set for a while. This is great. So it was kind of my dream job, which I luckily kind of landed on my feet to get. So I was there for 5 years, I guess, and then just started working my way up through different different jobs, and then went out into the state government sector doing recreation management and lifestyle choices, I guess. So I was very firmly entrenched in the bubble, I guess, of sports and rec management in Adelaide, and probably next step would have been to explore interstate or, you know, what other opportunities arose if fate hadn't intervened.
Yes, I am interested in this fate discussion. So what happened next? How did you find yourself where you are? You obviously met a bloke, I'm imagining. Yeah. Is that the
same? Yeah, age-old, you know, farmer wants a last story, I guess. So, well, I think anyone in South Australia will be able to tell you there's a place in Adelaide called the Woolshed. It's kind of the go-to place where all the country people hang out and go to, and my sister and I and our circle of friends, I would say we were very self-proclaimed regulars of that place. Once again, we still thought we were country girls coming from a small city. So, yeah, I met my future husband, Nick, at the Woolshed, where all beautiful romances start. And from there on, he didn't live in Adelaide. He was just there on the weekend. And yeah, then the kind of adventure kind of took a side lane, and I've ended up here in Oru on our farm that we bought together, 6 or 7 years ago.
Was it love at first sight at the Woolshed?
Oh no, it definitely wasn't love at first sight. I think I was more preoccupied about getting to the pizza shop next door before it closed. So. Which, if anyone that knows me, I'm fairly scatty and definitely get a bit excited about what I can eat next, and my priorities are pretty firm on that. So, no, it certainly wasn't love at first sight. I do remember thinking it was hysterical that he wore boots and a hat. I thought that was the funniest thing ever. He's still saved in my phone as Nick Boots, because that's how my friends and I all knew him, you know, for the first 6 months of meeting him. It was just the guy with the like legitimate country boots on.
A legit country boy. And you know, not where you expected life to take you. So things obviously progressed after you got your pizza in your belly, and obviously, I don't know, did he get your number? Is that how did it actually
happen? Yes, yes.
How far away was he from Adelaide? He was in town for a bit of fun.
So he was a couple of hours from Adelaide. We swapped numbers and kind of had a few chats. He definitely did put in a fair few hard yards, which was great. Now in hindsight, But yeah, so he came down a few times and had some dates, but of course he brought his dog with him. And I lived in a townhouse in Adelaide. So dates were kind of Nick, Maxie, the Kelpie, and I just getting takeaway and sitting at the beach. Or, God, is this guy for real? He's brought his work dog to my house. Where am I going to put him? But no, yeah, it kind of progressed from there. It was a bit of a slow moving beast for the first, year or so. I just actually couldn't wrap my head around how logistics would work, and how he certainly was not going to move to the city. He had been to boarding school in uni and done his city stint, and that was out of his system. And he was very much ingrained in country lifestyle. He grew up on a farm. He was an agronomist at the time when we met. It took a little bit of working out in both of our heads of how logistics were going to work. So we got there.
You did, and logistically you moved to the farm, as is often stereotypically the case. Is it his family farm or another farm he'd been working on?
No, it's he grew up on the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia, and his parents sold their farm. So he was working as an agronomist turned stock agent in the Clare Valley, which I thought perfect. I could probably adjust to that. That would suit my lifestyle, my needs. And then he moved for work to Oraru. So I had some friends from boarding school from Oraru. So I thought, oh, cool, we've had some fun, one or two nights in Oraru. So Nick moved here, and then by chance a job that I was doing in town came up for the region which encompassed Oraru. And I thought, oh, we'll take it and I'll come here, we'll move here. And Nick and I kind of thought we would do 12 months here in Oraru, and then we would go somewhere bigger, fun. Our words were fun, inverted commas, I guess. But, it took a bit of adjusting. There was quite a few tears when I first knew we were living in town. I couldn't believe that the shops weren't open after 1 o'clock on a weekend for me to get my chocolate fix. just the little things I just didn't cope with very well. But the community was very welcoming, and I guess in the end we stayed longer than we thought. Well, clearly we're still here, but then we decided that we had to buy a farm here. An opportunity came up and we bought it, and we've since renovated the old farmhouse into our kind of forever home, which we love, and have a great little spot outside of town. And we're really lucky, and yeah, this is it now. So.
Yeah, it is it. And you've obviously grown your family, you've had twins. At what point in your relationship with Nick did you start talking about kids? Because how old are they now?
They're 5.
And you've only been there for 6 years?
No, so we've been in Oru for 11 years now.
Okay.
But yeah, the twins are 5. So we've been on our farm for seven years.
I know that motherhood has been one hell of a journey for you. Tell me a bit about those discussions with Nick early on about wanting to have a family, and then, what that journey was like for both of you.
Yeah, sure. I don't think we ever, I can't pinpoint an actual conversation. I think it was just at the start and assumed we had very same values about, values, and, we both kind of wanted the children, the family, and I had always thought that probably, subconsciously I'd end up somewhere smaller to do that. So whether, Adelaide, I'd always had in the back of my mind that it would be a lovely thing to bring your kids up in a smaller community. So I just didn't probably think this small. But it turns out that has also been a massive win for us. But, so we always kind of were on the same page that we'd love children. We wanted to get married and do all of that first and kind of establish ourselves wherever we were before we did that. And I don't think it really ever occurred to us that, I think in my mind I was like, right, well, when you want it, it happens. So it's all good. It's going to be smooth sailing. Get our timeline out and that's what will happen. Yeah, we'll stick to that. So, yeah, so we're always on the same page about it.
And so tell me a bit about the journey to motherhood in terms of your attempts to fall pregnant.
Yeah. Look, I was at the time I thought I was being quite confidential and, wouldn't speak about it, but you can't do anything in a town like this without everybody knowing anyway. So ignorance is bliss, I guess. But we got married and tried to have a baby straight away. And it just wasn't happening for us. And I am an overthinker and a planner. So I was very heightened right from the beginning about why it wasn't working. And, you know, whereas Nick's a bit more, casual, it'll happen when it happens. So I was, Dr. Google is my best friend, I'm ashamed to admit. But we probably tried for a year and then went down the route of getting all the testing done and those kind of things. And it was just something that no one could pinpoint. There was no red flags or anything. So I don't know, in some ways unexplained infertility is probably worse because you can't pinpoint something and fix it. So after a year, we started down the fertility treatment path, and we went straight to doing IVF. So once again, I kind of thought I'd known, a few of my friends and family had done that and had had great success, which was amazing. So it didn't occur to us that we would struggle with that, but we certainly did. The moving parts of doing fertility treatment, and I know that there's lots of women you've spoken to about, doing it in the country and that kind of thing was very taxing, but we just continually were doing cycles and not getting any results. Or, unfortunately I had two that you get a positive pregnancy and then they don't, then I miscarried them very early on. So it was very heartbreaking and a horrible time. But looking back on it now, completely worth every tear, I guess.
How much was the travel? Like how much far did you have to travel to Adelaide for treatment?
Yeah, to Adelaide. So 3-hour drive one way. So and I would go every couple of days in the middle of a treatment just so I'd get up and I'd set my alarm at 4 o'clock and get to Adelaide, get my bloods done, do a ultrasound or do a scan to track my cycle and then jump back in the car if it all looked okay, and then get back here and hopefully start work at about, mid-morning was what I would do. Otherwise you've got the complexities of getting your bloods done, having to wait for your blood test to get back, find out if they're altering your medication, then waiting at the pharmacy for a prescription to be sent through to get the meds before you head home. So many a time I just... There's only so many times that you can do a day trip to Adelaide before it starts becoming not exciting and you just literally sit in the car and wait. So, it was a long journey, but completely worth it now. Lottie and Hudson are the light of our lives and we're so blessed to have
them. When you say long journey, how long are we talking with IVF?
We did it for 3 years. So we did... we did 5 full fresh cycles of that, full IVF cycles, and then you have obviously the other frozen cycles in that where you have frozen embryos that are ready to go. So when it doesn't work or, when I miscarried, that you can put a frozen one. So you still undergo all of the scans and the meds. You just don't have the egg collection every time. So we did 9 transfers, I guess. Which I fuzz over how much money that cost us. That kind of thing.
I'm not gonna ask you.
I didn't even add it up by the end.
Wow, 9 rounds. So, that's a lot. Yeah. Just emotionally.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's so emotionally taxing. And now I am very open about it. I guess now hindsight, I'm sure is easier to be open about it. But when I was doing it, I felt like I was the only person in the whole world. Mm. And even Nick, who was so supportive, still doesn't get the impact that it has, the medication and hormones and emotionally on a woman's body. So, I tried to kind of put my everything is okay and get on with things on in the community and sport and those kind of things. But you're, you kind of know everybody knows, but you're not, it's all a whole big complexity. And
I was going to ask you about that. You've got friends having babies, I'm sure. Technically it's 4 years because you were trying for a year and then 3 years of IVF. As a newly, wed couple in a small country town, what was that like navigating that potential awkwardness of people perhaps wondering, is there an announcement coming? And were you open about the struggles and was it isolating? Mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't open about it. I should have been now looking back, but people presumed, you know, and there's always going to be someone, gosh, I will never ask anybody when they're going to have a baby now. but I, you know, people would, you know, presume that there may have been, you know, things are wrong. And lots of babies popping up around us, which is so lovely. And you're happy for people, but you also go home and have a cry. so it's a really hard thing, especially for close friends, you know, to be happy for them. But people were pretty, I think by the, you know, the last couple of years, people were just, you know, left it to us. And I'd talk about it. The people were supportive and, you know, kind of turned a blind eye. Like the amount of times I'd pulled a hamstring or a calf at netball and I couldn't play that day and things like that. But then they'd see me jogging down the street 3 days later, you know, things like that. So, yeah, it's a struggle, but every woman or every couple that has been through this will tell you that there's no right way to navigate it or how to feel, which is worse. You can't just read something and fix it.
Yeah. And finally, I guess with the happy ending being the twins, tell me a bit about that news, because you mentioned that you'd suffered some early miscarriages. So I imagine even when you got the news about, you know, the pregnancy with the twins, that perhaps it took you a while for it to feel like it was going to stick. Is that fair?
Yeah. Oh, pregnancy was horrible for me. And it was just stressful. I didn't believe it at, you know, any given time. But I think when we went for our 8-week scan, obviously knew that I was pregnant. I pretty much had bought shares in the pregnancy test company. So I was literally testing probably twice a day, you know, as soon as we'd have an embryo implantation. So I knew I was pregnant. We went for the 8-week scan. One of my good friends here was doing sneaky blood tests for me at the hospital. Well, not sneaky, they were prescribed, but, you know, just doing it, letting me in the back door and doing it. So she had an inkling looking at my hormone levels that there might be two in there, but we certainly didn't. We were just hoping and praying for, you know, one healthy, viable embryo in there. So we went in to get the scan, and we'd been through such a long journey that we're in waiting, and I was, you know, horribly ill, you know, just was sick with fear. And they did the ultrasound, and the fertility specialist said, you know, here's a heartbeat. Oh, and here's another heartbeat. And the run that we had, and my husband Nick just said, oh, shit, has it got two hearts? Like, he's just like, we were just expecting bad news. So we thought, oh, and I'm looking at him, are you serious? this is where our instant go-to was there would be something wrong. Once we found out it was twins, we were elated. It was amazing. We had 24 hours of such excitement. And then I bled all the way through my pregnancy. So it just wasn't relaxing. I certainly wasn't a blooming, blushing pregnant person, blowing pregnant person, that's for sure. I was a stressed out, probably getting skinnier by the minute instead of fatter by the minute pregnant person.
That is so tough, like pregnancy after loss, and then also the added complexity of twins, which obviously turned out to be complex because they did come quite early. Tell me a bit about what happened, like tell me about going into labour or however that happened. Tell me about the birth.
Yeah, we went to Adelaide for our 20-week scan, which we were so excited about. We were setting ourselves short goals, I guess. Went to Adelaide for our 20-week scan on the 23rd of December. So we're going to do a bit of last-minute Christmas shopping and get the scan and head home. And I went in for my scan, and I just remember the people there, just, you know, a bit of whispering going on and bit of stuff, and I thought, oh. And then my doctor, we left and we saw two heartbeats, so I was happy. We left, and my obstetrician rang and said, oh, I don't think you can go home. Your cervix is short, very short. Just take it really easy. We'll check it on Boxing Day. So we were hosting Christmas at our house at the farm, and that certainly, so Nick whipped home and got everything, and we stayed in Adelaide, had a very low-key Christmas. Wondering, but we were still pretty ignorance is bliss, like, oh, okay, we just need to be near a hospital so they can stop it or something. So Boxing Day went back in, and it had shortened again, and so I went into hospital at 20 weeks on bed rest. So I all our plans, nothing was, I was too scared to organize anything, you know, for nursery wise or anything like that until we'd gotten through our 20-week scan. So I essentially had left left the farm at 20 weeks and didn't get back until so I was on bed rest for 4 weeks, which anyone that knows me, I'm quite hyperactive, I'm pretty full on, and I'm not great at sitting still. So bed rest was hysterical for me, I guess. I'd count cars out the window, I'd colour coordinate, I'd look at the traffic light sequences. I would have annoyed every one of my friends with pointless messages, videos and phone calls. Just so, yeah. So I think we still were a bit ignorance is bliss. The staff there were amazing. They took us, they said these babies are coming early. It's just a matter of how long you can hold on. And we got a tour of the NICU. I remember going in there and there was these 32-weeker twins and looking at them and just, well, they wheeled me in. I looked at them, burst into tears, and they were so tiny. And I was like, right, I'm going to get past 32 weeks. This is what I'm going to do. But we still didn't really know what we were in for. Like, it's, you know, Nick had to go back home because there's shearing to be done and life goes on the farm. So my amazing sister and mum and dad and family and friend network were my constant stream of visitors. But mum and dad lived 4 hours away and my sister's 2.5 hours away, so they would kind of rotate times to come and hang out with me. But there's only so much talking you can do. So at 28 weeks, my waters broke. So turns out that Lottie was very impatient to join us Earthside, which actually explains a lot about her personality now. And my waters broke. It was terrifying. Nick was back here. I rang him. He jumped in the car. I rang my mum and dad. They jumped in the car. Rang my sister. They jumped in the car, and it was kind of a race whoever could get here first because I just wanted somebody there with me. My sister Jess, she rolled in first, and then Nick rolled in, and he had literally been out in the sheepyards loading sheep. So he rolled in his farm clothes. He smelt. He had dust everywhere. The nurses, they were waiting for him so I could go to have a section. The nurses made him shower and put on his scrubs first because he had literally just dropped all the work, and I assume the truckie finished it off, and he hightailed it to Adelaide. So, our twins were born at 28 weeks. They were tiny. They were a kilo each. And we, had a bit of a very long road ahead, but we're so blessed that they have just kind of thrived. And, you know, it was very, they say at NICU it's two steps forward, one step back, and that was very, very true to our time there for the next 3 and a bit months, that's for sure.
Oh, Kate, that is 28 weeks and 12 weeks early. That is very early. And
very early, yeah.
What did the road look like? Also not forgetting the complexities of having the farm a few hours away and just that isolation piece of being in a city away from, you know, your comfort zone. How long did you have to stay in hospital for with them?
I had a section, so I stayed in hospital for a week, which was good because I was in the private hospital that adjoined the public hospital where the NICU unit was. So, but essentially, if I wanted to see the babies, which of course I did, they were born at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night, and, you know, to get to them the next day, so they obviously will you in when you're at recovery and you meet them, I guess, but we weren't allowed to hold them or anything. They were in their hemocribs, all hooked up to, it's very daunting, these little translucent little babies. And then they take you back to your room, and then it's, I guess it's when you feel right to be able to get up and go to see them. So I am a very determined human. So the next morning, I guess at 6 o'clock, I had to prove that I was good to go and that they could remove, you know, catheters and those kind of things. And we went. So we went over to the hospital next door, and then I just stayed there for 3 months. So Nick stayed with us for a week, and then I just moved out. They had a unit on site at the hospital, which is an amazing resource for country families. And I had nowhere else to be. So I just became this pumping, milking. I'm sure the nurses would have got sick of me because I was just there all the time, which I don't know how you do that. If, you know, the mums that have young children and then have a prem baby, it just blows my mind how amazing they are to that juggle, because I certainly was there, you know, there for 12 hours a day. I'd go back to the unit. I would ring every 3 hours. I feel like I got my a medical degree on prem babies. I, you know, would write everything down and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it's what you do, and it's what lots of mums and dads do. Yeah. I guess.
That must have been a really not just difficult but also isolating and lonely at times, because Nick's not even able to be with you, and you've just become a mum and you can't hold them. Like, it just must have been so difficult.
Oh, it was. It was horrible. It was an absolutely horrible time of our lives, but also an amazing time at our lives. I think we'd get past, you know, milestones and we would celebrate them and we'd be so excited. I remember my sister and friends threw me a surprise baby shower one day while we were there. And, you know, the intention was, and it was so lovely because I obviously didn't get any of that stuff. We'd barely probably told people we were having a baby at the time. I ended up in hospital, and to leave the hospital that day, I think Hudson had a setback in his breathing and had to be hooked back up to a CPAP machine. And so then I'm going out to this surprise baby shower, you know, and it's just so overwhelming. You live in a bubble, and then I had to go out to a restaurant, and, you know, and the amount of people, my friends, I had travelled or made the effort to get there was fabulous, but then you sit there the whole time thinking, I shouldn't be here, got to get back, you know, those kind of things. So, yeah, it was certainly very challenging, but we've had a great outcome. So, and there's, you know, you see some very life-changing things in NICU with other families and what they go through. So we are very lucky.
Tell me about the day you brought them home to the farm. That must have been hugely emotional and perhaps a bit daunting after 3 months having them in medical care.
Yeah, absolutely. They never promise you a day that you can take them home. They keep it very vague, and now I understand why, because there's so many moving parts to it. But we kind of had a day in mind. It was after their due date, and we booked it in, and they said to us, traditionally mum and dad have a sleepover with the babies in a hospital room on the baby ward before you go, you know, just to make sure that you're all okay, that you can cope. And I was like, well, nope, we're not doing any of that. We're just getting in the car. Thank you, but no thanks. I must admit, the last 4 weeks of the twins being in hospital is a bit of a blur for me. We as I said to you before, my dad passed away while we were in NICU, very unexpectedly, and my dad was the glue, I guess, the happy larrikin that kept our family, you know, family of girls in check, I guess. So after that, I think I lost the plot a little bit, in the sense of I was just very, it was a blur. I sat there, I remember the amazing nurses put a bit of a screen around me so that the other, you know, normally you chat to other people and stuff. I just didn't really want to talk to anyone. The time that dad passed away was the crucial time of starting to actually breastfeed. So I'd been pumping and pumping every couple of hours the whole time I was there, because it was the only thing I could do for the babies. And, you know, the day that they rang, well, the day that we found out about dad was, we've got this photo, it was literally 10 minutes before of the first time I'm dual, you know, 10 feeding the babies, breastfeeding. And it's just this amazing experience that went from the highest high then to get this phone call and, you know, so obviously had to fly home and be away from Hudson and Lottie for 24 hours, which was excruciating, but also wouldn't have missed, you know, that component of saying goodbye to dad. So I kind of missed the window for them to latch on to breastfeed, which, so for the next 4 weeks, you know, before we're going home, I was adamant I was going to get that back and I would try to do that, but I didn't. So I became known as this crazy pumping lady. I would, so for the next 12 months, I just pumped literally every 3 hours.
12 months, Kate.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
just under 12 months. So, yeah, I just pumped because I think in my mentality, and I don't have any issues with formula. I think everyone does whatever they want to do. But in my mind, this is the only thing I had kind of let them down in that sense, and this is how I could control this, you know, and stuff. So, geez, so we just about had to buy a new chest freezer. So going home and getting them home was really great, but it was very bittersweet because my family as a whole wasn't there to celebrate with us. So, yeah, it was the first week home probably wasn't as exciting as I had always envisioned taking our babies home, I guess.
Well, you're grieving grieving one. No, don't, you don't have to pull yourself together. It's enormous what you went through, like grieving your dad while also trying to get your head around becoming a mum and trying to celebrate them being alive and with you. Like, I just, that must have been such a bittersweet time. And then to come back to the reality of, as you say, farm life never stops. So you kind of back into, kind of, that probably hit you in the face a bit too. And twins, my sister-in-law had twins or has twins, and they're five now actually too. And far out, listening to her stories about what it was like with two, with twins. Not easy. So, and I want to work my way up into this weird village that you found yourself in, because you said earlier, like, you lived in a share house at some point. You ended up finding yourself back in a bit of a share house scenario with newborn twins. Can you explain to everyone what on earth happened?
Oh God, you wouldn't read about it really. So we got home. I had 4 weeks. My mum and my sister were on rotation of helping. Nick, my husband, had never really been around newborn babies before having ours. So he really, he had no idea what to expect. And so after 4 weeks, I got this first phone call I got was from my auntie and my cousin, who was quite a bit younger than me, just finished uni, got her first teaching appointment, which was amazing. And it turned out it was in Oahu, of which she had never been to Oahu, and she was flying back from Europe that day and, you know, had to start 3 days later. And could she stay with us for a week or so? Yes, she could stay with us. So Catherine, bless her, she just back from this European amazing, you know, jaunt, has rolled up in Oahu once again, didn't grow up in the country or had no farm exposure. And moved in. So she moved in, which was hysterical. And then my best friend had a relationship breakdown and needed somewhere just to, you know, take a minute. So Carly came and she moved in. Thank God we'd bought the big old farmhouse. So Carly and Catherine moved in with us, and we weren't really sure of how long they were going to be in there, but it probably was up to probably 3 months. So poor old Catherine, it was probably the best form of contraception she's ever had as a young girl. She was amazing. She did what she could, but geez, she it was a baptism of fire for her. But, you know, many hands make light work. So Carly, my best friend, was unreal. She was going through a really hard time in her life, and she would take the twins out, take the pram out. She'd just go for walks, probably have a bit of a cry herself while I had a bit of a cry in the house, and then Catherine would just be flitting around, just, oh, you know, look how funny, I'll take a photo for this. Oh, that's good, you know. So, God, if Catherine, I had to say to her every morning I'd wake up and she'd say, good morning, and how did you sleep last night? Good sleep. If you ask me that one more time, I'm going to lose my mind. So, but she was also amazing because it just added another element of lightheartedness to our household. It was hysterical looking back on it now. And my husband to this day sees both of those girls still and just shudders. He's like, oh, God, it was just way too much going on at that time.
Describe the household to me. Like, just paint us a bit of a picture.
Well, you had Catherine. You know, Catherine thought that she might be able to help Nick with some of the farm work, that she could lighten the load of that, because usually that would be my job. So, you know, you'd have Catherine asking questions, like Nick would have to say, all right, well, we're shearing. Okay, I'm going to just go knock out the rams for the shearers. And Catherine's going, okay. And she'd be worrying that Nick's got, could he have a hammer in his hand? So she thought he was going out to knock them out with a hammer. You know, so she's going, oh, I don't know if I can go out and help. Oh, I guess I can hold the hammer. Oh, so we're laughing at her. I'm hooked up to a double breast pump. I've got, you know, we're watching Farmer Wants a Wife or some, I'm a reality TV addict, so we're probably watching something like that, which Nick certainly didn't want to watch at nighttime. I'm pumping. Carly's got Hudson. She's feeding him. Then she's passed him off to Nick for burping because Carly didn't want to hit him too hard, and we're fine doing the, you know, back slap. And then Catherine's got the other baby and she's trying to change a nappy, and we're watching her put that on back front. But, you know, you've got to learn. So it was just a production line all the time. Or, you know, there'd be a message because those two girls are at work. What's for dinner tonight? Okay, I'll bring home this. And it was amazing and it was hysterical. But, Nick, I think even now when he hears a newborn baby cry, he just associates newborn babies with that kind of bedlam, and he's got PTSD. He's, you know, our best friends have newborns, and he's like, oh, I'll take them when they're one. I'll play with them then. So, yeah, it was a comedy of errors. And then, of course, my sister and my mum would come very frequently to help. And so, you know, we'd have to kick one of them out of one of the spare rooms. You know, we'd have someone sleeping in the dining room or in the playroom. Or, you know, it's, yeah, hysterical. But sleep deprivation has a lot to answer for of what you find funny at the time.
How long did they live with you for?
About 3 months. And when they left, on and off. So, 3 months, I would say. It was really that time when we were in the trenches as well. So I was home, obviously, full time at that time, and trying to, which is also probably not something I was cut out for. They were there for 3 months. And then I think at that time, and just the hecticness of that time, and when they left, we did notice it. Like, we certainly noticed it, a big gap. But it's also probably the time where living in Oru, the township and the community of Oru, we were sold. We were like, this is the amount that a small community rallies around you is second to none. And we will never forget the kindness and just the thoughtfulness and of people. Even people not our close friends, we had amazing, you know, a group of close friends, but it sold it for us. This is home. I wouldn't have it any other way.
I'm sure that having, I guess, roommates as a new mum to newborn twins wasn't on the plan, but how did that support you? Because that is really, when you think about it, the sense of a village, literally, you know, your friend and your cousin moving in at this most vulnerable time in your life, in a way. What did you feel like? How would you have survived without them? If you think about going home with the twins and not having them there versus having them there, I'm sure it was a bit of a circus at times. But yeah, from that village support, how did that feel?
I think you just, there was always just an extra set of hands, because honestly, I just really underestimated how hectic twins will be. Like, you don't think about logistics of bathing one and drying the other in the middle of winter, and you know, stuff like that. So it was amazing, just the support network. And you know, we'd just sit outside and just like the silence, but all of us just sitting there in silence, and we all had all our own stuff going on. And just knowing that, I guess, that the support was there if you needed it. We certainly learned to read the room of when we all got home, and you know, those kind of things. And thank God we're on a farm and there's lots of space. So it was amazing, and I love the connection that Catherine and Carly both have with our kids now. They've been there since birth, and the connection, they know them. They didn't just see them sporadically, which probably may have happened, you know, if we weren't all housemates. So I just love that connection. I just think I was really lucky to have that support network, as well as my amazing mum and sister, who were going through horrible times themselves, you know, adjusting to dad. So if I said to Nick now, oh, the girls are moving back in for 3 months, I think he would lock the doors or move out. But
I hope they're not listening.
Not because of them. I think we just it was just hectic. It was a lot of females in the space, and he had a very emotional wife that he had to deal with, let alone two others that we'd outvote him. He didn't really get a say in it.
Yeah. And not only that, but even for you, like, it is an emotional time, and I can't imagine having, I mean, I could imagine my best friend, Jess, you know, but still at that time in your life where you're hormonal, you're lactating, you might have ups and downs, you're exhausted, is not having space. Like, I know in the house you had space, but having other people live with you, like, that's a little bit intrusive for a new mum.
Yeah. Look, and there was elements of that, and the girls were very aware of that as well. We also wanted our time as a family, as the four of us. So they would come and go. So, you know, they wouldn't be there 7 days a week. So, you know, on weekends they'd head off, or, you know, and we were just kind of a halfway house, really. They were very, very aware of that. And if they were here 7 days a week, it probably wouldn't have worked, but they were great. And Catherine eventually found somewhere to live in Oru with someone, friends her own age, which I'm sure she enjoyed much more than putting. And you've also got the complexity, you know what it's like when you've got a friend and they have a relationship breakdown. There's all of that to unpack and overanalyze, and, you know, that kind of thing. So we were running a couple of dramas at a time. It was just mentally exhausting fixing all the problems of the world.
What a memory to look back on. I think at the time, you know, really difficult, but as you say, kind of you look back at the circus probably with a bit more humor and lightheartedness now. Yeah. And yeah, and you know, obviously they moved out and you guys moved on with your own kind of family unit at home. What has been the last few years like beyond the newborn trenches with the twins, farm, life in general?
Yeah. Oh, look, any time that someone says to me, oh, I'd love twins, I'm like, you'd love twins from about 3 years onwards. Like, we're so lucky because I don't think we would have gone down the IVF route again if we had ended up with just one, which we would have been so grateful for. Hudson and Lottie are very different and they have just brought a whole different element to our lives. Nick and I have been and always were very much of the opinion that having children wouldn't change, obviously would change our lives, but we bought a farm and are doing it ourselves. So we don't have that generational, you know, the succession fallback. So we're really trying to build our own business. We both work full time and we're great little joiners. We love, you know, our community clubs and things in the town. I'm really passionate about giving back to a town that has given us so much since we've moved here. So I would say our home life is chaotic. Nick does an amazing job on the farm. We run just sheep. So that's all in kind of out of hours, weekends, slow times from him as a stockie. I have a great job, which is flexible, which we're so lucky because there's no childcare options here in Oru, and there is no, we don't have family nearby. My sister's half an hour away and she's a lifesaver, but so it's been hectic. We've been so lucky that Hudson and Lottie have so far, touch wood, just really hit all their milestones, and we haven't had a lot of the associated problems with prems. But I will never forget the NICU and those staff and people did for us at that time, and I would eventually like to do something to give back. But yeah, it's just crazy. It's chaotic. I am probably the world's worst farmer, but I try.
That's the most important.
I just don't have the patience for it, and we are very much a stereotypical farming couple that the sheep yards does not bring out our finest traits in each other.
Oh, I love it. And you mentioned, Kate, that the lack of childcare. So what has that meant for you? Like, you're working full time now, the twins at school.
Yeah, so they started school, which has been a game changer for us. Yeah.
But up until now, it's been just full time with them?
No. So I probably didn't cope that well at home. I love them. I loved, you know, having that year with them. But I needed adult time. I just needed so I went back to, and we also needed the income coming in as well. So I went back to work on a part-time capacity when they were one. And we just had this amazing lady that we knew that lived in Oru, that her grandchildren all live elsewhere, and we paid her to have the kids. In that, which we were so lucky, in that you don't get access to any childcare rebates, to any of that kind of stuff. So really it was, you know, we were just so lucky, and she was amazing. She raised her kids like she would raise, you know, her grandchildren, and they think of Danny and Sue like a different, like a second set of grandparents, I guess. So we were so lucky, and she had them up until we went to school, like on days. So we were lucky, but there's a lot of people here and the community's rallying hard to try and get something, and I feel a bit like a fraud now because I don't need it anymore. And but I still would love, yeah, it still needs to be something, because we it impacts every aspect of our community not having childcare.
Yeah, it's such a huge issue for so many rural communities and so many women. Absolutely. I speak to, and you take it for granted for those of us that have them nearby, or if not in our town, then in a nearby town that's, you know, less than half an hour away or something. Yeah. But Kate, it has been so wonderful to hear your story. I just love it. It's a bit all over the place, this crazy journey. No. I just mean like that chapter of your life with, like, there's so much going on, like new motherhood, prem twins, friends moving in, cousins moving in, pumping the farm, like, just, you know, I hope you've given yourself some credit for like surviving that time, and just the fact that you've gone through that. And, you know, I did meet those two, your friend and your cousin, very briefly, which is when we had the quick chat, and I was like, we've got to share this story, because it is so unique. You know, I think that I know that it wasn't planned, but we have lost our villages as mums. So many of us don't have villages, and village doesn't mean family necessarily. It can be friends and your best friend moving in, but how beautiful that, as hard as it was, and it was only a short time that you had that connection with you, because, you know, it can be so isolating. I just think, looking back with Elliot, I would have killed, maybe not for 3 months living with us, but I would have killed to have had my best friend or, you know, a family member living, even living with us, particularly with twins. And yeah, I just think what a special, unique opportunity that was, and a fun, hilarious story for you guys to share with the twins in years to come, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even after that 3 months, like, it puts a new perspective on when people do have babies here, and that I know that I'm sure that the community organised an unofficial roster of who was going to head out to the Pierce's house at 4 o'clock when witching hour began to help Kate bathe. But I'm a staunchly, you know, help Kate bathe babies, and I'm a staunchly proud person, so they'd all pretend it was pure coincidence that they just got there at that time. Or, you know, my friend would send out her teenagers because they were just driving around, you know, it just happened to be at 4 o'clock, and they would stand there, you know, it was production lining. So yeah, it's given me a newfound appreciation and an awareness of, you know, how to support a new mum, I guess, because I, what those, you know, the meals that got sent out, the you know, we have a great family with young girls, have just been our lifesavers of looking after our twins and treating them as little cousins, I guess, you know, and having them, which we never expected and we never asked for, but it's just, you know, we all do our stint. I'm excited for my kids to get a bit older so then I can force them onto someone else that's had a new baby that they can be in charge. So, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful, that support. And it is a beautiful community. I wasn't there for long, but thank you for inviting me to Oruro last year. It will be last year because this is going to air in January or February 2024. It was such a beautiful event and such a beautiful group of people. And who knows, maybe I'll be back one day. But in the meantime, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Kate. It's been so much fun.
Thank you, Steph.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Don't forget, the RFDS's primary healthcare clinics are working to better the health outcomes of those who live in rural and remote Australia. Every day, the RFDS holds more than 68 clinics across rural Australia, from immunisations, healthcare checkups, referrals, or management of chronic conditions. RFDS primary health services mean there is regular medical assistance when needed for people living and working in remote Australia. Head to the Flying Doctor website to find an RFDS primary healthcare clinic near you. The link is in today's show notes. That's it from me, everyone. I'll catch you next week.